We're talking this hour about the late writer David Foster Wallace. Personally, I'm really looking forward to seeing the new movie about him. But the people who were closest to him, his family and editors, have been really critical about it. Mostly because they think David himself would have hated it. He wanted people to pay attention to his work, his words. So let's do that. Over the years, we interviewed David Foster Wallace a few times. The last occasion was in 2004. He just published a short story collection called Oblivion. And Steve Paulson asked him to begin by reading from one of them. It's a story about how horrified kids are when they look at their parents' lives.
I had begun having nightmares about the reality of adult life as early as perhaps age 7. I knew, even then, that the dreams involved my father's life and job and the way he looked when he returned home from work at the end of the day. His arrival was always between 5:42 and 5:45. What occurred was almost choreographic in its routine. He removed his hat and topcoat and hung the coat in the foyer closet, clawed his necktie loose with 2 fingers, entered the living room, greeted my brother, and sat down with the newspaper to wait for my mother to bring him a highball. It is in hindsight that I believe the dreams to have been about adult life, but I do not believe I knew or could even imagine, as a child, that for almost 30 years of 51 weeks a year, my father sat all day at a metal desk in a silent, fluorescent-lit room, breaking only occasionally to answer his telephone or meet with other actuaries in other bright, quiet rooms.
It's wonderful. So evocative. Did you have that kind of dread when you were a kid?
I think in a country where we have it as easy as we do, one of our big dread vectors is boredom. I think little edges of despair and soul-level boredom appear in things like homework or particularly dry classroom stuff. I can remember the incredible soaring relief of when certain teachers would say we were going to watch a movie in grade school. And it wasn't just a hedonistic, oh, we're going to have fun. It was a relief from some kind of terrible, terrible burden, I thought.
Did you sort of look at what your parents were doing, or your father in particular, and think, oh my God, I don't want to become like that?
I mean, both my parents were teachers, so they always got pale and haunted looking when there were big stacks of papers to grade. But I think a lot of this has more to do with friends' parents and friends who've become kind of office workers. I just got interested in the reality of boredom, which is something that I think is a kind of hugely important problem, and yet none of us talk about it because we all act like it's just sort of something that we have to get through.
Well, it's funny because as I was reading that, I was sort of thinking back to my own childhood, and my father was a professor, and he would, after dinner, he would typically go on up into his study, close the door, and I don't know what he did, but I remember thinking when I was pretty little that this doesn't seem like fun to have to sort of do this night after night, and I didn't want to become like that. Of course, I sort of have become like that because, you know, I go home and, you know, I have my own homework as well. But I'm wondering if that resonated at all for you.
One of my little family stories that Mom always tells is that on the day in second grade when we all had to talk about what our fathers did for a living, I said my father didn't do anything for a living. He just stayed home and wrote on yellow paper. Because he was a professor too. I know that part of what interested me in the story was trying to remember what I thought about what my parents did when I was a child. Because when you're a child, I don't think you're aware of how incredibly easy you have it, right? You have your own problems and you have your own burdens and chores and things you have to do. But yeah, I think my intuitions were very much like yours. I think when they went into these quiet rooms and had to do things that it wasn't obvious they wanted to do, I think there was a part of me that felt that something terrible was coming.
Yeah. You know, what I find interesting about what we've been talking about and also the passage you just read is your public image as a writer is you're typically described as one of the leading figures of the postmodern, hip, ironic generation of writers now in their 30s and early 40s. But I read somewhere that you really think of yourself as a realist.
You know, these various classifications are important for critics. I don't know very many writers who don't think of themselves as realists in terms of trying to convey the way stuff tastes and feels sort of to you. I mean, a lot of stuff that's like capital R realism just seems to me somewhat hokey. The idea that small, banal details are somehow more real or authentic than large or strange details always seem to me just a little bit crude. The truth of the matter is when you're in an interview, you have to say all kinds of stuff. I don't really know what I am. And I don't think very many writers have any idea what they are.
Well, I'm wondering about for particularly people of our generation, I think we're roughly around the same age, both in our early 40s. whether there's a certain cultural landscape that you feel most compelled to write about.
I know that when I was in graduate school, those of us who wrote very much about what used to be called pop culture or advertising or television were really scorned by our older professors who saw that stuff as kind of vapid and banal. And I remember it was a really big source of conflict because in lots of ways we just didn't get what they were saying. I mean, this was our world and our reality the same way, you know, the Romantics' world was trees and babbling brooks and mountains and blue skies. So I think probably if there's, I'm 42, if there's something that's distinctive about our generation is that we've been steeped in media and marketing since the time we were very, very small. And it's kind of a grand experiment because no other generation in the history of the world has been that mediated. What implications that has, I don't know, but I know it affects what seems urgent and worth writing about and what kind of feels real in my head when I'm working on it.
Isn't that also complicated, though, because the danger of writing about, I don't know what you'd call mass culture or pop culture, is that it's going to seem shallow. In fact, you wrote an essay about this some years back, that the risk of just being clever. How do you say something original about this world that in so many ways is really pretty shallow?
Well, except for me, art that's alive and urgent is art that's about what it is to be a human being. There are certain paradoxes and there are certain hazards involved, I think, in writing about this world because there's the danger of being sucked into it and simply trying, for instance, to do something that seems very hip and clever and thinking the job has been done then. I've certainly done stuff like that and realized only later with horror that what I did was in fact just kind of regurgitated the same stuff that I've been hearing since I was 4 or 5. There's another side to it, though, is that I think at least for people like me, I'm 42 and I grew up, I don't know how many after-school specials and Hallmark Network things I've seen. A lot of what's quote-unquote realistic, conventionally realistic, ends up seeming hokey to me. Everything seems a little too convenient and the ultimate goal of it is to sell me something. And there's a part of me, I think, that recoils from that. And that's a problem because some realistic stuff really is alive and urgent. But I think for a lot of us about our age, we're looking for different less commercial forums in which to talk about kind of the urgent, moving stuff. I don't know whether that makes any sense, mm-hmm. but that's pretty much the truth the way I see it.
Well, I think the other piece of that is a lot of this commercial world, I mean, whether it's movies or, I don't know, advertising even, it's pretty compelling. You know, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And I suppose from a writer's perspective, you might want to feel like if you're going to write about this stuff, you have to be entertaining too.
It's a real problem. I don't have a TV anymore, but, you know, when I'm doing something like this and I'm on the road, I watch TV in hotels, and I'm appalled by how good the commercials have gotten. They're fascinating. They're funny. They're hip. They've got trunk lines into my, you know, high school-level anxieties and desires in a way that the commercials I grew up with never did. What it is a lot of them are the hip, cynical, cool people I went to college feeling intimidated by who are now making $2 million a year.
Now, I mentioned this essay that you wrote, I think it was back in 1993, about writing and sort of what various fiction writers are up to. And one point you made is that irony tyrannizes us. So the implicit message of irony is, I don't really mean what I'm saying. And you went on to suggest that the next generation of rebel writers might ditch irony in favor of sincerity, and I think I'm quoting here, who treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. And I guess...
Yeah.
is that a critique of your own kind of writing?
I don't know that it's that. I mean, the thing even sounds dated to me now. I think it's less that than an articulation of the thing you were asking me about before is, you know, what is it like to be working really hard on the stuff at age 42, having been marketed to all your life? I mean, because you want your art to be hip and seem cool to people. You want people to like the stuff. But a great deal of what passes for hip or cool is now highly, highly commercially driven. And some of it I think is important art. I think The Simpsons is important art. On the other hand, it's also, in my opinion, relentlessly corrosive to the soul, and everything is parodied and everything is ridiculous. Maybe I'm old, but for my part, I can be steeped in about an hour of it, and then I sort of have to walk away and look at a flower or something. If there's something to be talked about, that thing is this weird conflict between what my girlfriend calls the inner sap, you know, the part of us that can really wholeheartedly weep at stuff. And the part of us that has to live in a world of smart, jaded, sophisticated people and wants very much to be taken seriously by those people. I don't know that it's that irony tyrannizes us, but the fashions that are so easy to criticize but are so incredibly powerful and authentic seeming when we're inside them tyrannize us. I don't know that it's ever been any different. That probably makes absolutely no sense.
No, it actually makes
total
sense.
That was my experiment at telling the truth.
It makes total sense. But can you hold those two impulses simultaneously?
No, but I think my personal opinion and what I tell my students is that if there's suffering involved in art, or however you want to say it, right now this is the form of the suffering, is to be the battleground for the war between those two kind of impulses, neither of which are stupid, neither of which are wrong, but it's not at all clear to me how to marry them. And I don't think it's been at all clear since about the 1950s. I just think it's where we're at.
Hmm. Is that what you're trying to do in your fiction, to sort of get at those two impulses within the same story?
For the purposes of this conversation, I'll say yes. But sitting in the bright, quiet room in front of the paper, it's much more, oh, does this make me want to throw up? Does this seem real? Is this the sort of thing the person would say? It's much more kind of boneheaded and practical than that. Hmm. You realize this, right? There's something very artificial about once the book's all through galleys and, you know, now I'm engaging in critical discourse about it. I might be right, but it's very different than what it's like actually to do the things.
That's David Foster Wallace talking with Steve Paulson in 2004. Really makes you miss him, doesn't it?